Now we're rolling. For real. All formats. Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Music and or Lyrics, and it is about, well, the contrast between music and lyrics as means of expression. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about music and lyrics, Mr. John Charney. Say hello to the wonderful folks. And explain where the hell we are and what we're doing here.
Hello, everybody. We are in the middle of Loretto, PA, and we are in a graveyard, a place that I am well aware of as far as past experiences. I went to school here, as well as wonderful co-host, the sexy man, to my 12 o'clock. So that's where we are.
Yeah.
I love it here. Are you videotaping me?
Yes.
Is this live?
No.
Okay. It's Memorex.
Memorex.
Right on.
In fact, okay. I'm going to stop recording the video and we're going to get to this conversation right now.
I'm ready, man.
Ready.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, so this difference between the two solitudes of music and lyrics. And by the way, you can keep going on the Omnichord if you want while we're doing this. It's a little spooky, you know.
Yeah, as of right now, I mean, I think we still need some beginning of show music, so...
Yeah, you know.
Chord change. Okay, so...
So, yeah. So you came to me with this idea, but it seems like, honestly, this is a conversation we've been having for 20 years now.
Yeah, it's something that's... important to me as an artist and a musician, just simply because of the fact that I think music is the ultimate form of communication. It's the quintessential language barrier. So I don't think that an art form as wonderful as music needs to be relegated to pop standards or even just quote-unquote song standards with lyrics, blah, blah, blah. And the flip side of that is, nor do you have to just do instrumentals and be unfocused without a song structure. So they're kind of a yin and a yang to one another, in my opinion. I think you need both. But equal measures, I'd say, though.
Equal measures? Because, you know, I think there's this interesting aesthetic, cultural moment, I don't know, conflict that we're tapping into here. Which is, you know, this real question of, you know, there is one extreme, and, you know, this happens a lot, is this sort of acoustic folk singer-songwriter, 3-bar chords, and a feeling.
And a story to tell.
And a story to tell.
And a musical discipline to ignore.
Yeah. And... there was a time when, and a lot of people find that relevant. I mean, I, you know, in Pittsburgh, we have the radio station WYEP, where the music matters, but it's, you know, white people with acoustic instruments, with feelings.
Oh, what more do we need then? This topic is over.
Yes, it's over.
Later.
I mean, but it's a whole aesthetic. It's a whole... And it's one of those, it's... I always equate that genre of music with abstract expressionism.
Mm.
In painting. Because you can splash paint on a canvas. You can learn 3-bar chords on acoustic guitar.
Mm. Yeah.
And that barrier to entry is so low.
Mm. Mm.
But that summit of doing that well is so fucking far away and high and impossible. And I will say, whenever I see somebody who does white guy acoustic guitar really well, well, you know, when I see 10 people who do this well, I'll make a top 10 list and they'll be on it.
Right.
And I haven't. I've been going to shows for 20 years now.
Okay.
And I have not seen 10 people do it well.
It's not easy. You know, I speak from experience as far as being an acoustic soloist. But I think what you're referring to is that folk demographic, however. Right? I mean, because, like, I like to sprinkle in everything. I mean, I do classical guitar. I do instrumental compositions on guitar, which is perfect for that. You can do accompaniment with melody and all that kind of thing. And I don't think it has to be relegated to strumming chords and telling a story, you know what I mean? The other cliche also is the guy at the party in the corner with the acoustic guitar trying to, you know, act all sensitive and get all the girls and all that, and through faux sensitivity. But me, down deep, he loves Judas Priest in the heart, you know what I mean? It's the same thing, but it's Dave Matthews front.
Yes.
So.
Which, and that I was thinking about then, that's the one joke in Animal House that has aged well. Yeah. Is when John Belushi grabs that guitar from that guy and smashes it against the wall. Says, "Sorry," you know, but he's not.
And sideways glance was perfect the way you did that. Yes. Anyway, so,
but yeah, and it's for me too. Thinking about if you're talking about music as a pure art form and literature as a pure art form, there is also this question, Clement Greenberg, the American art critic, speaking of abstract expressionism, right? Why are paintings not paintings of stuff anymore? And what he said was, under modernism, under modernity, because, well, we can take fucking photographs of landscapes and of people, painting has then become the spreading of pigment on a surface.
Mm.
And that's all it needs to be, because there's something else that perfects portraiture, and there's something else that perfects landscape.
Exactly.
And for me, as someone who reads poetry, who writes poetry, who's part of a little minor figure in the Pittsburgh literary scene, there's poems. That's the good words or poems.
I'm switching it up to country waltz, but it's not cooperating.
Press the button on the bottom.
Yeah. The red one?
The one next to the red one.
Now push it again.
No, just hit one of the chord buttons. Ah.
We'll fix it eventually.
I'm going to come over there, damn it.
This is unprecedented.
Actually, I was the wrong
podcasts.
Button.
Oh, there we go. Country swing, see? This is so much more applicable to country swing. But anyways, you're talking about perfecting art forms,
right? Art forms. And having taught public speaking at a university level, sometimes one of the assignments was, you know, is having the students do a dramatic reading. And there's always one of the things that taught me a lot was when students do song lyrics, and they try to do a dramatic, they try to read song lyrics like a poem, and it doesn't work.
Okay.
And I can tell it's, you know, and sometimes even students have picked songs that were incredibly meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about how, well, obviously, if those lyrics could stand on their own, they would be poems.
Mm-hmm.
But they need musical accompaniment to have strength and power and meaning to people.
Right.
Which is also, a part of this dynamic.
Of course it is. I mean, because, I mean, just relating back to what I said earlier, I think that, in my opinion, I think music is the ultimate form of communication. I mean, I'm saying that from personal bias, of course, because I've been playing music and loving it all my entire life, but you can go, for just by way of an example, you can go to Brazil and see a concert, and they'll sing the guitar solo. They'll sing the verse melody. They'll sing the chord progression. And much as how lyrics can be interpreted in a myriad of ways, so can music. I mean, that musical riff can mean something to one person and another thing to another person. And since there's no wordy thing weighing it down, it becomes even more cosmic, in my opinion. It becomes more of a galactic language rather than a flat language, which words can sometimes be.
Yeah. Which is also why, for me, I have a hard time with opera in English.
Right.
Actually.
Yeah.
You know, because if the emotion is there, you get it.
Yeah. That's the point,
isn't it? You should be able to get it.
Yeah. Like, convey where they're coming from, you mean, from their demeanor and their emotion and all that.
Yeah, and from the voice. And the voice then becomes just another instrument, as opposed
to I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's key there. Because honestly, I mean, I've been listening to music all my life. And what I've gravitated to has been the sound of the music, the sound of the voice, not always what they're saying. Later on in life, I started to understand what they were saying better, because when Kiss would be doing the song Makin' Love, I was 5 years old, mind you, and I was listening to Makin' Love by Kiss in my bedroom, drawing pictures of them, and I thought he was saying, pick your nose. You know, pick your nose, making love. They sound so kin to one another.
Oh, man.
Spiritually, too. But no, I'm just saying that not in music, words are not meaningless. But I think, again, what you said, though, the vocal being another instrument is really the key there. Because you can't have, in the genre of music, you can't have music or lyrics without music. But you can have music without lyrics.
Yeah.
So the people who think that the music is beholden to the lyrics, if it's not music anymore, it ceases to become music. The art form of music is compromised in that regard. So, you know, and again, I don't want to fall too far on the side of just the instrumentals, because of the fact that, you know, many of my influences and my loves are, I know I'm getting stale with this. I got to step it up a notch. Here we go. D. So,
the magic of the omnichord.
It is, man. It just goes.
Literally, omnichord.
Exactly.
One chord.
Yeah. So the point being, though, I mean, like, I listen to, my influences are all lyrical bands. You know, my big four, which I've mentioned countless times on some podcasts that we've done. I've already, what happened there? Oh, that's what happened there. So, like, my big four are all primarily lyrical. They have lyrics in their songs, but I'm listening to the music.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm getting at.
You know, and it's funny, because in the way that this conversation that we've been having for 20 years... Metal Zone.
Yeah, that's a perfect pedal, where if you don't agree with someone, and they're talking, just be like, and that's not what I was doing there, but like, someone would be like, yeah. And, what? What'd you say? Oh, okay. All right, it's back.
Oh, man, you redlined. We redlined.
Nice.
Yeah.
The Metal Zone Country Swing redline.
Yes. Because I went the other way. You know, it's like weird. We've crossed paths somewhere in the middle.
Uh-huh.
Where...
Right around the Take On Me band. Why am I forgetting? The Aha.
Uh-huh.
That was the other spectrum for you.
That was the other spectrum.
Yeah.
There was a time when I first started really getting into music where the words were the most important thing.
Right.
And I think it's like I needed my ear needed to be educated and learned things. And I went through a long period. And actually it was Elliot Smith who got me to go the other way, where I just stopped paying attention to lyrics at all. Like me.
He made you not pay attention to lyrics?
Yeah, so his philosophy was, for his songs, which I find fascinating, he would write with such selective ambiguity that in some cases even he said he didn't know what the songs really meant. And when he figured it out, he stopped playing the song live.
Oh, wow. And figured he said, it was finished.
It was finished.
Well, let me ask you something real quick, because that brings up something for me.
Yeah.
This is a little... I don't want you to forget that, though, because that's a good thread, but I don't want to forget this either. What do you think about live performances being, and tours being, hindrances to creativity and simply being redundant? Because I think they're commercials. I'm starting to get to that point where I think where tours and shows and concerts are sapping away from an artist's creativity. Look at the Beatles. The Beatles never toured after Rubber Soul. Look what they created.
XTC, after Andy Partridge's Freak Out.
Okay.
You know, they went from a very simple post-punk band.
Right.
To, I mean, you were in a cemetery. It's summer. In Loretto, we're in the Laurel Highlands, there's huge puffy clouds. And the perfect soundtrack to this is their XTC album, Skylarking.
Right on.
It is the springtime record for me.
Right on.
You know, I even have a Skylarking day. And it just feels like English country springtime for me, and I get to have it in Pittsburgh.
Wonderful.
So I think there is an element to that. I think there's an element under the world where... recorded music has little to no monetary value anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now bands are doing the 30th anniversary album in its entirety tour, which I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
And I will say the other way is, for me, someone who started in the basement playing music and immediately got a Tascam before I even knew how to play, and started recording before I knew how to play.
Right.
And then I got a show, my first show, and I was like, oh shit, how do I make this portable? Mm-hmm. How do I play these songs live? What do I do live?
What if something happens when I'm playing live?
Yes, something or even like, because
what
know,
if this would... happens?
Yeah, the metal zone is a yeah.
It could happen.
It could happen. You could enter your metal zone.
Or on purpose. Anyway.
Yeah, for me, it's usually on purpose.
Yeah.
But, because, I mean, I would record things that would have 6, 7, 8 tracks, and I'd play guitar, and I'd play bass, and double track the theremin, and there'd be keys on there. And
how do you replicate it live?
Other than getting 7 other people to be in a band with me?
Right.
You know?
Well, that brings up another point. Like, I was in a band, and I will not name the person whose opinion was... not akin to my own. But anyways, so...
Let's just call this person the wanker.
Okay. So the wanker was always under the staunch faith belief that if you couldn't replicate it live, you shouldn't record it. Hmm. And that really chapped my ass. Because... isn't your ultimate goal when you're working on something to do the best possible job you can do? And that relates back to live and touring and having to tour and doing the music commercial and taking it to the masses and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Did Stephen King worry about whether or not he could perform the Tommyknockers live whenever he wrote it? Did he worry about Jimmy Smits being a turd whenever they did the made-for-TV? No!
Lot of really bad... Stephen King movies.
There are, you know.
Which is funny you should say that, because for me, you know, if something's live, is it not only just the fetish of, oh my god, that person's on that record, like, we're in the same building, or the same parking lot.
That's what
lot,
it used to be for me.
Or whatever.
Or meeting Mike Patton and having him tell me to go relieve myself. Anyways.
Yeah. Which...
was the pin in the balloon. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes, which, you know, which is Walter Benjamin's work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction. You know, we live in a world of infinite copies when you get the real thing.
Yeah.
You know, my one and only now stadium show that I probably will ever go to, I saw Radiohead last summer.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
The
it was quite a moment for
fucking
you.
Fucking thing I've ever experienced in my life.
Maybe they are in an arena band.
They're not an arena band, but I don't know. I left thinking... and I don't know if I even like any arena bands.
Yeah.
How does anybody...
Springsteen.
...find that... Oh, fuck no. how does anybody find that musically fulfilling? I am in the same hockey arena as Thom Yorke.
Yeah.
Whoa, dude! Yeah. And you know, there's always the, how you doing, Pittsburgh? He said where we are. That
yeah.
moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus, like, well, let's see what happens here. Let's plug some shit in yeah. and see what happens. Which is why I find myself now, like, I own metal recordings, but I see metal shows, and that's when I listen to metal, is in person.
Sure.
For some reason, and I don't know if that's something about, like, my home stereo setup.
Or that just being the environment to listen to it.
Yeah.
So that's a nice opposite side of the coin with that. Like, whether or not that type is better replicated live versus being in the comforts of your own home with your feet up and Libby wanting to play catch.
Yeah.
So it's that that's actually a nice counterpoint there. I like that because that, you're right. I mean, I don't listen to metal anymore like I used to.
Yeah.
Like I'll still listen to old Metallica. I'll still listen to things that inspired me a ton once upon a time, but I'm not buying any new metal records. I'm just haven't, you know what I mean? I don't know. So that might just be the deal. Here comes a jogger. Yes. He's going to love this, isn't he?
Yes. Oh, he's turning the other way. I think he's afraid of us.
I think so. Did you say herding the other way?
Yes.
Or did you say turning? Because I like herding better. But anyway, no, that's good. That's really, really good. I like that.
Yeah, which, and I think for me is like, even that's the thing also about like going to punk and hardcore shows, which is also, I think it's really hard to capture that well on a recording, but also live when people lose their minds. And like weird shit
it's too
happens.
Much.
It's too much.
I'm sorry.
Metal Zone's too much. You know, listen to people lose their minds and listen to, you know, looking at the drummer thinking like, wow, is that person's heart going to explode?
Right.
If this sets another 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, and, believe me, I can relate to that.
You know.
Playing 3-hour shows at my advanced age.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, that has a nice redeeming quality in and of itself, for sure.
And there's the danger of it too. I mean, you're sometimes like you're in these really sketchy places.
Yeah. Gooskies.
The Rock Room. There was that time, you know, back when the great Pittsburgh hardcore band Eel, the lead singer Jimmy, who I'm going to have on this podcast soon, hopefully,
nice.
Used to use an angle grinder as an instrument.
I remember we talked about this.
Yeah, and, you know,
mishaps.
Am I going to get showered in sparks? Is the grinder going to explode and blind me?
Yeah, just make sure you... knows how to turn down the nuclear reactor so you don't have another Chernobyl on your hands. Shameless plug for
which
that show.
Anyways. And he doesn't use the grinder anymore because somebody got cut in the face.
Where? Who?
That wasn't him.
Was it in the audience?
Yeah, well, actually, they were opening for the story is...
Okay, I remember this. But retell
the rumor
it, please.
Is they were opening for an actual Japanese hardcore band. And the one guy was so excited that he tackled Jimmy... As he was using the grinder, and the grinder like caught his face. And,
oh, that's
like,
his fault. That's his fault. I'm using natural reverb out of my green tea jar that I'm drinking out of. Didn't they used to? They did that in old time radio. I think the Shadow would do that. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? Yes. So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes. Which I think opens the door to another thing. I want to get back to the Elliott Smith thing, but we should get back to the fact that...
Yes,
not
I did not forget
the
Elliott
Omnicord,
Smith thing.
But I insisted that you play the Omnicord through two pedals because I have 2 9-volt batteries.
The Shadow knows.
Amp.
Yes.
But yeah, so the Elliott Smith thing, the performative element of it, yeah, he said, you know, and you don't always fully understand a dream, but it affects you... emotionally,
right on.
And makes you think,
and it literally brings creativity out of you. I'll come out of dreams with melodies and riffs and record them immediately.
Yeah, which
so I don't forget them
is something to be said about like how this art form can work, and it doesn't need to be explained. Because I guess that's the thing about bad singer songwriter acoustic music is when it just says. When it just says it. When they just say what they're thinking and feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is bad writing all around.
Totally.
In every genre and format.
You might as well just be talking to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I guess there's really... Isn't the point really not to limit any of these art forms, but to do them well?
Yeah, I mean,
you know
that's
I mean?
The Clement Greenberg thing. Like, let's see how far pigment on a surface can go. What can we do with pigment spreading on a surface? And that's one of the things that, you know, because you think I didn't start really playing music for real until like 2 years ago. And this, you know, my normal pedal board has 18 pedals on it. And, you know, I give all these amps and all these things.
I hope, like, I was an influence on
you
this.
You absolutely were.
Yes.
But there's also the drive of, like, well, what can we do here? What's possible?
Uh-huh.
How far can we go to exploit this? And, I mean, we should also not so shamelessly plug. You just put out a new record that you've been working on for...
I worked on, it's under my name, John Charney, C-H-A-R-N-E-Y.
And there'll be links on the podcast.
Yes, and the title of the album is A Drop of Love in an Ocean of Hate. It's on YouTube, Spotify, the entire world, wherever you want to find it, it's there. I worked on that album for 5 years for a myriad of reasons. The first reason, the most important reason, was just technically each song probably has 50 tracks on to mix. Like, the drums would have 13 mics. Because I wanted this is the thing, okay? I like options, I like possibilities. And when you have 50 tracks, you have options and possibilities to throw it all at somebody for 30 seconds, bring in two instruments for 10 seconds, bring it back, maybe half, maybe pan some of them to the right, mm-hmm. then to the left. But it adds up to a lot of time spent, you know, and you have all this material that you want to release. But it's a nice way to record, it really is. And the final option would be different versions of the songs. Like, yeah. Say if I do this full band album, and then all of a sudden I want to do an acoustic version of it, because there's acoustic guitars all over it, there's acoustic instruments and percussion all over it, you can take that vibe, and it becomes something a little bit different, you know? And it's like... you have zero limitations. So yeah, it took 5 years to finish, mostly because there were 50 tracks a piece and learning Pro Tools more and more and all that kind of thing. So yeah.
Which again is like that artist drive for infinite possibilities.
Yeah.
And infinite maybe perfection, exploitation of...
or the pursuit of which.
The pursuit, yeah.
Yeah. Because it's that carrot that you... It's a benevolent carrot to chase, the pursuit of perfection, since we're human beings. And then sometimes in the interim, the imperfections are more interesting. So
yeah, this is true.
We are going way off today. I love it.
Love it, yes.
This day is so free. It lends itself so well towards going off on tangents.
Yes, and hopefully this mic is picking up the bird song in the background.
It has to be.
It has to be. I got the gain up all the way.
So. Nice. Perfect.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Which, yeah, is something to be said about, you know, a theory of an aesthetic that we're discussing here and that we're building. And I think we have been discussing this.
Sure.
In 20 years, it's just maybe this is the first real time.
Yeah.
Where we're hitting record on something and talking about it directly.
It only took us 20 years.
It only took us 20 years.
But we're here.
But 20 years of learning. I think 20 years of...
oh, yeah.
Experience and shows and recording and...
I don't think it's any accident that we're at this point now because of the fact that you're playing instruments and you're recording and you're performing live as well. You know what I mean? So these things kind of line up, I think, a little bit more as we both experience it more. And I'm perfecting my art form more too, man. Like, again, the pursuit of it. So this is probably why the planets lined up for this.
Yeah.
So...
So what else is on? You have notes. You have notes. Well, no, I think that's amazing. I mean, you think about it. I mean, you're not My Bloody Valentine, who worked on a record for 19 years.
No, that's not going to happen.
Or, you know, even Loveless.
Yeah.
I think they spent a week recording a tambourine part in one song.
That's
a week.
Overkill.
It is overkill, but that album is amazing.
Okay, then.
That album is a watershed moment, I think, for music, and the world was different after it came out.
Then that but was worth
a week
that
could do a
week
tambourine
long,
part. Yes.
It was worth that weekly tambourine track, the week-length
tambourine track
or the time they spent on it. But no, yeah, I mean, like, isn't the ultimate goal the best you can do, though, again? You know, the finest thing you can turn out. But when you have, as I recently told you, 867 musical files of ideas that are yet composed, but yet, like I said, I found those tracks on my phone that I had since 2011. I still have the same phone. Put them on my computer, started culling them down into song ideas. Mm. So those 867 ideas, some of which were, you know, conversations with people and stuff like that, but ended up with like 165 song ideas. And some of those ideas have like at least 10 riffs in them. Because, so you can see where this is going. You can have three songs within that idea that branch off to more. So I'll probably never record all of them. But at the same time, again, that's that carrot to keep chasing, that creativity carrot. Where, hey, I spent 5 years on my last album, so what? I got all this other stuff to do.
Yeah.
And why not live to 100 to see it through, you know?
Yeah, which I will put... this is maybe where the paths split. Maybe the two roads converge in the woods. Because I think about sometimes like also like punk DIY. So that's the thing. So I've been recording digitally with a laptop and an interface. The other recordings I've done is with a handheld GE mono cassette recorder. It doesn't even have a radio on it. I had it 20 years ago when we knew each other. A mutual friend of ours, Mr. Chico, used to actually borrow it to listen to tapes and then record over those tapes. And I'm surprised I got it back. I'm amazed it still works. I'm
surprised you told me this now and waited this long because it's a triumphant memory there.
Yeah.
Triumphant memory sound.
And so I've been also recording direct to cassette.
Hey, Earl.
And so it's been, that's been interesting. And then you think about, for me, like a band like Guided by Voices that will have 50 song ideas. And so then, you know, they put out, you know, 20-some, 30-some track albums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're actually just, I mean, Bob, the whole Bob Pollard thing. I mean, how many songs has that guy recorded? Mm. And the recording quality has gotten better, and they were on a major label for a bit. But, like, those first records, B-1000, which had a recent anniversary, those were recorded in a basement in Dayton, Ohio.
Right on.
On Alien Lanes, it says between washing machine cycles is the recording.
So it wouldn't be, like, surface noise.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be surface noise, but there's plenty of lo-fi.
Yeah.
And would just do it and just crank
realism.
It out. Yes. And I think about that, too, and I think about that DIY spirit and that, what do you do then with the happy accident? Because I think a lot of those records, the sound and even the stuff I'm doing, other people do, there's the happy accident.
Right. Bob Ross.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well...
Absolutely. Happy little accident.
Oh, well, believe me,
surrounded by happy little trees.
Oh, so many.
Except for that one that's dead. Those
that
two.
Trunk that we couldn't haul out of the woods for me to sit my butt on, and I'm sitting on the hood of my trusty 2002 Toyota Camry with 206,000 miles plus. But the happy...
In the salt belt. You've made that work.
This is right. I mean, like... Rocker panel replaced on one side, but oh well. But no, the happy accent, like, expand upon that a little bit. Do you mean like a mistake? Do you mean,
is it a mistake? Is it
quote unquote? Of course, I mean.
I think, is it a mistake? Is it just, you know, the way things come together? Oh, I think the gentleman is coming towards us.
Oh no!
Yes.
Should I play some jogging music?
Maybe. I think he's just kind of walking.
This is pretty good jogging music.
Well, you know, there's that idea, you know, Elvis Presley recorded those songs for Sun.
Right.
And then he went over to RCA.
Uh-huh.
He signed the deal with RCA, and he tried recording with RCA.
Uh-huh.
And those songs didn't sound right.
Okay.
And for the life of them, they were like, how do you...
Do you mean like a 70s sideburn period?
No, we're talking early. We're talking when he first got on RCA.
Okay.
So, you know,
what year was that, like
Sun...
58-ish or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
Early Elvis.
Right on.
And... You know, he made these records, and they were popular, and people liked them, and then he went over to RCA, and they had good equipment, and good gear, and everything.
Right.
And it sounded awful.
Okay, and so it took away from the spirit from what he was doing.
Well, actually, it was literally the crappy equipment they had. RCA, in order to make Elvis Presley records work, then went back to Sun, and were like, well, we gave you a little bit of money for taking your number one thing. Yeah, we need the board and all of those microphones.
Wow.
And they took, I mean, they got it so that they could make Elvis Presley records.
They actually let them take all that stuff out.
For a price.
Why wouldn't they just, like, say, be a little subsidiary here and let our producer oversee things and just record it at Sun? That seems a little overkillish.
It seems a little overkillish, but, you know, major label gets what major label wants.
Yeah, and then there's also the sound of the room, so that's kind of short-sighted on their end.
Yeah,
but corporations, what are you going to do with them, eh?
By the way, speaking of which, this is a total divergent. Have you read the New York Times Universal Music Vault? There's an update
you
today.
You just brought the day down to a crashing halt. I've been trying
There's
to forget
an update
about this.
Today.
I've been trying to
they
forget
listed
about
the 800 bands and artists that they think all the stuff is gone.
I know Elton was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, so many people. The entire Chess catalog. Gone.
I just love how they tried to cover that up, too.
And they still are.
Oh, that's just... I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, how are those things not in a fireproof vault, first of all? Aren't those things that they can construct to protect things like that?
Yeah.
I mean...
But they didn't care.
Oh, my God.
They didn't care. They were saying that, you know, one of the original Atlantic warehouses burned down.
Saying
one label, I forget what it was in the original story, not the update that came out today, the original story, there was a label that they wanted to recycle the reels.
Mm-hmm.
And so to make getting the tape off the reels more efficient, they hired people with chainsaws to cut the reels in half so the tape would just fall out. And then they could take the metal and throw it in a dumpster. Yeah, I had to read that article in sections because it was freaking me out.
This is
bad.
What happens when you put businessmen and power-mongering, soulless idiots in charge of things that matter. That's why the world turns to shit. That's why there's wars. That's why there's hunger.
You need to be metal zone it while you're saying this.
Damn pricks. Did you hear that? Listen to it again. That's why the world is ruined. That's why things like that happen. No respect! But no, seriously, I'm not trying to get flippant with this. I'll turn the metal zone back off if it appeared that way.
The mood was right.
All right, we're back. So, I mean, like I said, I don't even know how to properly convey or funnel the anger that's simmering inside my small brain into a gigantic world-dominating, corporate-killing, de facto chainsaw that a non-hardcore band would use on a guy's forehead. Because, I mean, how... They're, like, shooting themselves in the foot, too. I mean, like, you need those masters. What if you want to do new mixes, you know? And then you got Eddie Trunk, who I usually listen to and like, the heavy metal slash rock type guy, saying that, oh, well, this isn't going to affect the listener. All your favorite recordings are still preserved. They're on CDs, digital form, and then vinyl, too. But it's like, Eddie... What if you want to do a different mix? What if you want to do a different real master?
Beyond that, the article makes the argument that our capacity to record has actually vastly outpaced our capacity to play back.
Wow, that's interesting.
And so that's the other part about
how
this dynamic
so,
of
though?
Why these dynamics, why these masters, because that... half-inch tape or
deteriorates.
Whatever. Not deteriorates, but was able to record much, much more than you could put on a record or a CD.
Okay.
Even to this day.
Right.
And the argument is perhaps we're getting to a place where we are very close to master quality for the home consumer.
Mm-hmm.
But no. In fact, I just bought yesterday this record called Plantasia. Do you know about this? Sacred Bones just put this
but
out.
I love the sound, the title.
It came out in 1973 or 74.
Mm-hmm.
It is Moog synth music for plants. It's not for humans. It's for plants. It's supposed to...
music Plantasia. I get
it now.
That
is supposed to help your plants grow better.
Well, I just discovered yesterday that a plant that someone had given me 6 years ago in sympathy for my mother's passing... It finally bloomed. It never bloomed in 6 years, and it's an amaryllis.
Well, you didn't have that record. You got to go get that record and play it for it.
Sustained blooms. It would have
recorded 4.5 years ago.
Say that again, please.
It would have bloomed 4.5 years ago if you had that record.
Well, I'm just going to have to go out and get it now and ensure consistent blooms.
Yes.
So,
but that record,
it's interesting though.
It came with the original 1970s booklet, which is also a guide to caring for houseplants, which I actually need.
Right.
And like weird 70s line drawing illustrations and cartoons and stuff with it too. But then there's a note on the back cover that the masters for that record are lost. And Sacred Bones kind of half apologizing, saying, "We found the cleanest original vinyl copy we could to make this record.
Right.
And it's the best we can do."
Mm-hmm.
Not what we could have done with a master. That note is on in the booklet.
Though that's a lot more than Universal said.
Yes. Universal said, no, it's all still there.
Oh, man.
And there were more case studies of artists who were like, "Yeah, that's the 30th anniversary of this record. Can I put something out?"
See, isn't that typical?
We can't find the masters, but they're around.
See, isn't that typical of any conglomeration like that, though? They won't admit failure. They won't admit wrongdoing because their perception's more important than the actual truth. They don't. It's like the mafia.
Their stock value would. Well, actually, the other thing is Universal was thinking about selling off their music.
Okay.
And that was like huge part of their
part of
assets.
It too. But it's almost like the mafioso. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, someone doesn't pay up. What do? You kill them.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to show weakness. So these sellout pricks are not even owning up to it.
Yep.
Sellout mother pricks are not even like admitting it. It's again back to the whole political thing. Like they think that someone's going to swoop in and like devour their carcasses or something.
Mm-hmm.
They're already dead. The music's gone. I mean, like, what's the difference now? Why don't you just own up? But I guess that kind of pomposity and arrogance just...
Well, and...
Never ending.
Never ending. But then the other part about this, if you want another layer of greed in that story, you know, Hole, Soundgarden, Steve Earle, Tom Petty's estate, and Tupac's estate are suing.
Good.
And one of the things that they're suing for is also, didn't they cash in on the insurance for this fire?
Oh.
And if this is our intellectual property that burned up and our future potential income to earn money off of our intellectual property burned up too, shouldn't we have gotten some of that insurance money?
Another reason why they didn't admit anything. That's
they're
why.
They're trying to do a class action lawsuit and try to get $100 million out of Universal for this.
They need to burn them down a little farther than that. This is so egregious and such a breach of any musical sort of sensibility with think about that. You can't go back and get the masters to some of the most classic recordings of all time. You said every Chess recording?
Every entire Chess catalog, potentially.
Oh my god. That is, yeah, I'll let the Metal Zone speak for me on that one. Anyway. So, yeah, that's my opinion on that. Did you notice that I started losing a couple more hairs or got a little bit more gray whenever we brought that up. So
yeah.
I hope you're happy. Anyways.
Sorry. So I was eating breakfast at Sheetz this morning and read the update.
Oh, I'm sure it can only get worse. There's no way we've heard the last of this. Yeah, I've already seen probably, of course, Elton being one of my big four Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
Isn't that like all his masters? Like including good... Including Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Jesus, God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, apparently a lot of the stuff since Universal bought out Geffen, all those 90s alternative records that us Gen Xers, you know, couldn't get enough of.
Nirvana, I saw that.
Nirvana, Jawbreaker, Weezer, Soundgarden, gone.
Isn't GNR as well, like probably Appetite for Destruction,
probably, yeah.
One of the most significant rock records ever produced. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's gone.
That's just great. Another minor key. We need minor key for that.
Don't forget his minor keys.
Yes. But anyways. Yeah, that's my thoughts on that.
That's your thoughts on that. So how do we bring the two solitudes together between music and lyrics?
I'd say by not trying to pander to an audience, not trying to think that's what people want to hear. I think that you freely take everything on its own basis, on its own merit, on its own essence. If you have a song, say if you're a band that does like plethoras of harmony, say you're Fleet Foxes, Or say you're the Beatles, you know, to kind of relate them kind of sort of together. What if you have a song that you've written and it's patently clear that it really does not require vocals, that it stands on its own merits and is fine as an instrumental? Do you, A, put vocals on it anyway because your people or your fans are used to hearing you play those and it's more economically viable? Or you do what's best for the song? Do you do what's right for your art? That's how you merge the two. You do what's right for your song. You do what's right for your riff. Boil it down to 30 seconds. Does it need vocals? Don't put vocals on there if it doesn't. If it does, put them on. You know? I've done albums that are half instrumental and half vocal. You don't see that because people are too afraid to polarize. Yeah. You gotta do what's right for the music. That's how you rectify the two. Jesus, back to the metal zone. I think part of it's because I'm half standing up also, is why I'm getting so passionate here.
Yes.
I'm always passionate, but sometimes it doesn't always come out. But anyway, yeah, that's my opinion. What do you think about rectifying instrumentals and or lyrics?
I think two things. One, the fact that post-rock has happened.
Okay.
That you have bands like Mogwai and Godspeed You Black Emperor.
Sun-O.
Tortoise. They're just instrumental bands. I mean, you know, I've seen Mogwai twice. The one time, you know, Stuart kind of had a mic. And, hey, we're Mogwai from Glasgow, Scotland. And then he took the mic and he pointed it toward the wall. And then they played their set. And between songs, he would kind of swing the mic. Thank you. And
nice.
Then swing it back and, you know.
Probably don't even need one. Just yell out to the audience every time he needs to.
Yeah.
I think I've been at a show like that before where there's like, it's instrumental and they're like, this next song is called Love. And then they just launch right into it.
Mogwai's big. Mogwai's massive.
Yeah. Define post-rock a little bit more for me, though, because
I think for me is, okay, guitar, drums, bass, synth, whatever. Mm. Those things.
More major key.
Not... I would say that genre is, you know, they don't do the 3.5 minute song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
you're not talking about instrumentation because you said the usual rock instrumentation.
Usual rock instrumentation, but not played. You know, they don't really do 3 minute songs.
Formatting,
yeah, formatting. Right. I think different kind of chord structures, different kind of sonic landscapes. You know, I mean, Godspeed You Black Emperor will put out a double disc album that's
now
four songs. You know, Mogwai does movie soundtracks. In fact, I got to see them perform Atomic, which is, you know, a BBC documentary that they scored, and they actually projected the documentary with subtitles on a screen behind the band, and they performed the songs live.
I'm seeing a connection.
No words. You know, a band like, you know, people have called Tortoise badly plays jazz, but I don't, you know, buy into that. So that kind of, like, now there is this scene of people who are like, well, we don't care if we don't want verse, chorus, verse, repeat. We want...
music.
Massive sonic landscapes.
I'm seeing something
in a
more...
rock context, right? You know, you don't necessarily have cellos and violins.
Well, you can. I mean, doesn't Godspeed do that? I mean, some of their stuff has
some of their
verged
stuff
on
does that.
That.
Yeah.
What I'm seeing there is more of what you're saying about who's the guy Green something said about like particles.
Oh,
of
Clement
paint.
Greenberg.
Yeah. So. I'm seeing more of that happening now with what you're talking about, because I immediately drew a parallel to prog rock of the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, Yes did an album with four songs on it, Topographic Oceans. There's like four 20-minute songs on there. So within those 20-minute songs, you have these broad landscapes of free time where there's no beat, like this. That's very... beat-oriented. Like, they would do things where they would have, like, sort of like church organ, and then, you know, come in with sort of like a hymn-type vocal, where it was like a complete departure from the rest of the song. So, but now what I'm hearing with regards to the post-rock genre is more of the whole song being like that.
The whole song being like that, but there is, like, a weird, like, you know, they came into the world after punk, so there is a... still an urgency to it.
In a 20-minute song?
An anarchy to it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, listen to something like Godspeed You Black Emperor's Piss Crowns Are Trebled.
The one that I've that listened to...
That fucking crushes.
Asunder is... The first track on Asunder blew my mind.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Okay. Yeah. That was... I can hear the urgency in that sort of post-rock plotting doom moroseness going on there. You know? But I think that that sort of genre is awesome because there's total freedom there. But... we got to also think of it this way, too. If they're doing these 4 20-minute songs or 4 15-minute songs, whatever the hell the case may be, they should always have the freedom to do a minute-long vocal song if they want to.
Yes.
To not be worried about alienating their audience or somehow becoming something other than they were meant to be or blah, 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 blah. It's all about the art. That's, again, back to the idea of music and lyrics. How do they coexist? Within those bands, they can exist within those genres. Like Mr. Bungle, aren't they a great example of that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they haven't done an album in 20 years. The 20-year anniversary was California. It was about a month ago. It's really nice. But, yeah, I the post-rock thing has tons of potential. There's a lot of freedom there. In my opinion.
Yes.
Next topic. Do we have anything?
Freedom, perfection. Well, actually, we are 50 minutes into this podcast, and I have some concerns about the battery life of my netbook here.
How long do we usually go?
Usually it's around an hour.
Okay.
So is it maybe time for the bottom five then?
Up to you, my friend. Yeah, you're the interviewer.
Let's do that. Bottom five, make sure that this isn't lost for history. We don't have our universal battery failure moment.
Yeah, I covered all my notes.
Oh, good. So we're golden. So, again, let's plug this record one more time.
Okay.
And there'll be links, again, when I post this podcast, but...
Well, the first song on the album is in the key of E flat major, so... There we go. So, the album... and it comes in with a bang, so... the album is named A Drop of Love in an Ocean of Hate by John Charney. It's a solo album, but it features musicians that I know quite well. Dominic Peruso on drums. I've been playing with him since high school when we failed at playing at our senior talent show with 18 in Life because they decided not to do it. So UCL BC was well on their way to being the cusp of artistic integrity. And focus. So he plays drums on it and some percussion. Michael Maketa, a really, really talented dude who I think recently graduated from NYU with a degree in composing and conducting orchestras, like in the musical theater field. He plays keys and some percussion. Catherine Hull is on trumpet and accordion, and Gabby Lechek on vocals. So it's that sort of group there. I named it after myself. I mean, I it was done as a solo album because I wrote all the music, and basically spent 5 years of my life editing, producing, mastering. So it's really my creations and that kind of thing. Although it may sound more like a band album, I kind of spearheaded it. So, and then also the one that we did a year ago, right? Far away from today. Far Away From Today is also out there everywhere. YouTube, Spotify, just like A Drop of Love.
And you can get it on cassette.
Of course. So those are our shameless plugs there.
Yes.
Yeah, so go and check them out. Listen to them. And I'm not going to say support the music scene because there isn't one. So just support music.
Support music. Support DIY music, though.
Yeah.
We're doing this DIY.
Support good DIY.
Support DIY. You know what, though? Even bad DIY, it's a laboratory.
Yeah, this is
true.
It's
a laboratory. It's all a laboratory.
It's a labyrinthian laboratory.
Yes. All right, so now it's time for the bottom five. Here. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And I was in such a hurry this morning, I did not consult the other podcast lists. So these might be new questions. These might be old questions. People who pay more attention to this podcast than I do might know, oh, John said this last time.
I don't give a
Or did
rats.
Something else last time. So
I'll
let's
say
do it.
Different.
All right, five questions. Are you ready?
Nope.
All right, question one. Name an item from your childhood that you lost or got rid of that you most wish you could get back.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There's a huge list. Where do I start? My big wheel.
Oh.
My Evel Knievel guy that raced up and down and went on a motorcycle. Yeah, those two. This is a huge one. My first amp. My first amp. You want to know this? This is your best five. What's the questions called?
Bottom five.
All right. So angst portion here of the 5 at 5 here on Channel 5 is the fact that my first amp was a Gorilla amp, and my mom got it for me in 1985. My first guitar was a Cortez Les Paul copy. So the Gorilla in 1991, I think, 90 or 91, I sold it to a good friend of mine, Dave Anatelli, who is commonly known as Ying. I sold it to him, and for whatever ungodly reason, because I kept my first guitar and I sold my first amp. Recently I talked to him and he's like, well, I sold it to someone else, I can't locate it. So, sunny moment in The Godfather. Oh! Biting my hand, still with the metal zone. I finally found one on eBay, the same exact model, and it was like $50. Perfect shape, so I got it, and it sounded just like my old one, so kind of got it back, but not really.
I said, all right, question two. Name a film world you would like to visit or live in permanently. If you could Gumby your way into a DVD.
Wow.
Yeah, baby.
Yellow Submarine. Yellow freaking Submarine. I watched that movie with my little brother every day for like 3 years. He'd come home from school. He was like probably between the ages of 7 and 10. And the wonderfulness about my little brother, who's now 27, and I'm like, he actually, I was of course always aware of the Beatles. Who wasn't, right? Yeah. But there was that part of me, you know, when you're in your early 20s, like the Beatles, whatever. You know what I mean? Because I was listening to Soundgarden, you know, and Metallica in the 80s and all that kind of thing. Last thing you want to do is listen to the Beatles, right? But so I he brought over Abbey Road on vinyl in 1998. He was six. His dad is a huge, he's not my dad, but I still, he's kind of he's my half brother, but I call him my brother because those terms are bullshit. Half terms, I mean. Because you and me are brothers too, Matt. Yeah. So that's that. But anyways, in 1998, Aaron comes over. He's 6 years old. He brings over the Abbey Road album. I don't know why. He just brought it over. It was his dad's. His dad had the entire Beatle collection. And so downstairs we have my Aunt Barb's stereo and record player, and we put it on, and I'm just like, I never heard this. I never heard Because. I never heard Sun King. I never heard You Never Give Me Your Money. That's an A minor. You never give me your money. You never give me your... So you get the idea. it really resonated within me. And so, long story short, impossible at this point, but I don't care, because we still have 4 minutes, maybe?
Something like that.
And I ended up loving the latter portion of the Beatles catalog, and even getting back to the early stuff, too, and saw the genius in the chord changes. It would go to a D minor here, maybe. And Abbey Road became the one, and it became synonymous with going for walks in the woods with my American Eskimo dog, Crystal, who I wrote a song about called Ode to Crystal, and then with my little brother, and we ended up watching Yellow Submarine like every day after school, and it was, that world is so magical and wonderful and beautiful that it's always relegated to being a drug-fueled psychedelia caricature, whatever, parody of that culture back. It's not that at all. It's a creative wonderland, and I think it's beautiful. It's a Pepperland.
Nice.
Yes.
All right, question three. What is the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool?
Oh, my. Ah, bro. Let me think here. Strangest item I've ever eaten. This really needs to be tension music. I think you may have officially stumped me. I didn't think you were going to. Maybe a quarter? Let's come back to that.
Say a quarter. Question four. If we're talking about... Actually, this is somewhat related. If we're talking about the perfection of the arts. Name an artistic skill or talent you wish you possessed.
Oh.
What other perfection would
you
see?
Does it have to be other than music?
No.
Can it be within the genre of music?
Can be within music.
pipe organ. Pipe organ is one of the most amazing, intimidating instruments of all time. I'm most fascinated by it because of the fact there's four limbs working independently, reading four staves of music at the same time, ahead of time, so you're ready for the 30-second note crescendo that's in the measure that's 10 down the road, you know? So pipe organ probably, maybe even a baseball player too, because we have that in common, of course. Yeah. Something like that. I love baseball. But I really, honestly, there's not too much wishing. I'm pretty happy, man. I love being a creator. I love being a guitarist. Maybe like have discovered singing at an early age, because I started singing more seriously at 27 because I had to. My band broke up. Honey Boom!
No.
And I had to sing solo, so I kind of had to teach myself to sing. I still have good nights and bad nights, and I pretty much know what I'm doing, but that's probably the answer to your question. Probably like being able to have more roots in singing, to be able to do those lyrical portions of the lyrics versus and or instrumentals portion of my albums. Yes, these are good.
All
five
right.
Alive at five.
All right, question five. We're almost out of this.
No. But do we really want to be out of this?
Well,
that's more.
Let's
that's
see
the opposite.
Laptop battery's doing here. At least it's not raining this time. We
hell
promise.
No, it's not. Yes. It's perfect out here.
Question five: if you had to choose, would you rather live 100 years in the past or 100 years in the future?
Wow. Serious pluses and minuses to either. Let's investigate, shall we?
Yeah.
1919. Give me a little bit of historical perspective here. Was that World War I time?
World War I, Spanish influenza, millions dead. And then you got another World War you got to live through in two decades.
Now,
with the Depression in between.
Oh, this... That's the sound for that. No, this. I'd still do it. I'd do 100 years ago. Because
okay.
Two couple reasons. Number one, is this place really going to be around in 100 years? The way we're going right now?
Yeah, that'd be an interesting, you know.
You know, is that an existential question?
I think that is an existential question. I guess for me, it's like the thing I think about since I can't go back. I was like, man, wouldn't it be great to just wake up 10 years from now and like the revolution happened or whatever.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know,
without
there's
pain.
A different administration. There's a different, you know, worldview vibe happening.
Well,
and we were like, man, that was pretty fucked 10 years ago. Anyway, let's have some fun.
Here we are.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Indeedy do. But I honestly think, because so much stuff that I love, man. Can you imagine, like...
Yeah, you would get that mid-century post-war slingshot thing that happened. You would get all that.
I mean, being in the roaring 20s, you imagine being in New Orleans in the roaring
20s?
Yeah. Like hearing the birth of jazz...
Yeah.
Well, actually, it occurred far before that. Maybe like the aughts, maybe something like that, or the teens. So we'd be coming in at the end of that.
Thing I forgot to mention in the main podcast. We're going to go back for 1 second.
Yeah,
time out.
We are not done yet.
There is this amazing book by a man named Mike Kelly. I think it is. It's called Segregating Sound. It was a dissertation that is now a monograph, and makes the argument that folk music, blues, and country are just constructions that happened between 1880 and 1920, that there was this period that he calls the segregation of sound, and that there was something before 1880s and the foundation of the American Folklore Society where there was just Southern music, and Southern musicians played anything they liked. Like, truly, Robert Johnson, he said, was not a blues man, because he played anything that he liked.
Right.
But academics from 1880 to 1920, informed by the notion of race, segregated sound, in that there's, well, black people play blues, white people play
country,
and everything else, if it's vaguely ethnic, it's folk, which then invokes this sort of deep sense of time and history and cultural capital. And he questions the whole project in that book.
With the segregation of music?
Segregation of music. That there was this artificial construction that happened that was informed by the political bullshit at the time.
Mm.
And that, in fact, if we reevaluate and we can say, okay, maybe there was Southern music.
Mm-hmm.
that was a genre, that was a thing. These other tags are maybe artificial.
The second you mentioned segregation in music there, I immediately just lit up inside, because you know what the name of the next Wine of Nails album is going to be that I'm working on right now with
what?
Dom? The Death of Music Segregation.
There you go.
Isn't that amazing? And I've never heard of this before. We have a connection.
I didn't until I wrote that Bruce Springsteen conference paper. I didn't find that book either.
Do you like that title, or do you like The Death of Musical Segregation? Do you like The Death of the Segregation of Music, or do you just like The Death of Music Segregation.
The Death of the Segregation of Music.
Okay.
Because that's more self-explanatory. People are going to be like, whoa.
Right.
Yeah.
And my whole thing was less of a you know, relevant, quote-unquote, socio-political commentary or cultural. Mine was more genre-based, you know, which has roots in this too, of course.
Which has roots in this book, yeah.
Because I believe in the coalescence of everything. I mean, that's why I like bands that kind of go down those routes. And I think you learn more about people, more about culture, more about things whenever you're able to adopt those things more into your life and live them more, rather than just, I like that. You know, whenever you actually let that filter its way into your music, into your art, into your life, become more richer as a person. More rich. Sorry, yes. As a person. But anyways, I went off track a little bit there. Or did I kind of get into
that?
No,
I think we're in. I think that was a great note to end.
Perfect.
Yes.
So no five, the fifth
that was,
one?
That was five.
I thought we went back to another topic you hadn't covered yet.
No, this is in the main part. We went back to the main part. I meant, well, we were talking 20 minutes ago to talk about segregating sound, but...
Well, then already then.
It was the Indiana Jones hat, right before the door closed.
Let's end on a major note, though.
Yes. All right, so I think that's about it. I'm about to crank it up, and you're going to play the outro?
Yes, I am.
All right, so that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Though, actually, I know that's a lie. I'm recording it tomorrow. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify now. Spotify, I made it to Spotify.
Oh, no!
Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and when I remember, Mixcloud. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to our guest and musical accompaniment, John Charney.
Later, thank you.